Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us on this Monday edition of Trumpet Radio Live, back from hopefully a good weekend. Lots to talk about today. Threat of terror causes some airport panic. FBI says foreign hackers penetrated state election systems. If you live in California and that letter you were expecting never showed up, I think we know where it might be. Have you heard of preppers? That's kind of a new term, people that are trying to prepare for disasters. We've got an interesting write-up about them out in the Pacific Northwest. Some of them are congregating. And Kids in Screen, it's called Digital Heroin. Pretty interesting write-up. That and more on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on 101.3 KPCG. Well, this is Trumpet Radio. We're online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link there also at thetrumpet.com. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon with you here today. Grant, you have a good weekend?
Yeah, I had a great weekend. We went to a soccer game Saturday night and also to a Turkish restaurant, so had some fun experiences.
Is that minor league hockey team down there?
Soccer team. The OKC Energy. Right. Yeah, and then there's another one as of this year. We haven't been to one of their games yet.
They fill up? A lot of people go down for those?
Yeah, it must have been about 5,000 people there. And wow. It only seats about 7,000, so mostly full.
Popular sport, soccer. Yeah. A lot of people do like that. Well, that's good. There's, of course, a lot happening over the weekend and a lot of stories to talk about. One that is not very important, but I'm going to share it anyway. A lot of people like NFL football, and they always have a fantasy teams, where if you're not familiar with that, you pick players, and then you watch their individual performances, and if they do well, they have good stats, then you can win. So I know everyone's really concerned about this, but my first pick, I'll just share that with you, was Todd Gurley. I took him from the running back for the Rams.
He's healthy now?
I hope so,
because that would be a really good pick if he is.
So we'll see how he does. Don't let me down, Todd. I'm counting on you. I've got a lot riding on your shoulders, so we'll see how he does. But that can be kind of fun to watch those how those guys perform. You know, after the Olympics, I've had a few conversations with people, and one thing that's come up has been track athletes, or any of the athletes, but track athletes. How much money do they make? Because you know they run and then. If they win, they get some money for that, but you know they have to dedicate pretty much their lives to it. So I was wondering how much they made. I don't know exactly how much everybody makes. You know the top guys do pretty well. Usain Bolt, everybody knows him. He's worth $60 million.
Wow. Did not think it would be that much, for sure.
Now, and he's obviously the top guy. Mm-hmm. So most people aren't doing that well. But yeah, he's worth $60 million. He has a new contract from Digicel. Caribbean Limited.
I just heard about them yesterday. Yeah. That's a huge phone company down there.
He's their chief speed officer. So I don't think if you call in for tech support, you'll get Usain Bolt, but he is the face of the company. So he's making pretty good money and spending a lot of money. That's why it was in the news, because he's running all over London spending $15,000 a night on champagne.
Oh, wow. Must be buying it for a lot of people. I'd hope so.
He is, yeah. So anyway, but he's got $60 million. So anyway, it's kind of interesting because, you know, those athletes, they do dedicate a lot of their lives to what they're doing. They don't have time to, you know, go out and have an office job or something in most cases. Sometimes they're in school. Some of the athletes are in school, but he doesn't need anything else. He's making $60 million, or that's what he's worth, his net worth. So pretty interesting.
Wow. Yeah, $60 million. I could think of a lot of things to do with $60
million. Why didn't I run more when I was a kid?
No, it's lucrative.
I did. It wasn't fast enough. There was a minor league baseball game over the it was before the weekend, I guess it was Thursday, and it was interrupted by a sheep running across the outfield. If you ever go to those minor league games, some of the best things that can happen are things like this. This is Thursday's single A minor league game between the Batavia Muck Dogs and State College Spikes was interrupted by a fan on the field. The fan was a sheep. Presumably on hand for some sort of promotion, the sheep slipped onto the field when the stadium gate was opened, and they had to round him up, try to get him off the field. So, sometimes you hear about things like that happening at some of those minor league games, like you were talking about minor league soccer, and it's fun to watch those games. But sometimes something unique happens like this. Get a sheep on the field.
Yeah, even at that soccer game we were at over the weekend, there was a lot of taunting because they were playing Tulsa, which is nearby.
Sure.
And the fans were taunting each other a lot. And the one cheering section is literally 5 feet behind the goalie. Yeah. And so they're screaming at him the whole time. And they're like letting off this like fireworks smoke or something. And it's just fogging up the air. But you just never know what you're going to see.
Soccer hooligans.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know we
Big
had
time
any.
Oklahoma soccer hooligans.
Wow. Yeah, there you go. But no sheep.
No sheep.
Not this time.
I wouldn't have been surprised, though, because a lot of wild things seem to happen every time we go.
Pretty interesting. Some other headlines from the weekend, a little more serious. This is just kind of highlights the times in which we live here. LAX, it says, returning to normal after panic due to unfounded shooter report. And this has been in the news, of course. Operations returned to normal Monday morning at Los Angeles International Airport, after reports of a shooting sent panicked travelers sprinting through terminals and onto the tarmac. Los Angeles police searched the buildings and found no shooting occurred. Loud noises caused the panic. The travelers on the airfield caused the diversion of at least 27 flights to other airports and delayed 281 arrivals at the and departures. Two flights were canceled. Before the panic began, they say police detained a Zorro-costumed individual in Terminal 7. He was just wearing a costume for some reason and had a plastic sword. You should not do that at an airport, in case for the listeners out there. Don't dress up as Zorro. Well, really ever, but particularly at an airport with a sword. So, but anyway, you know, that's kind of, I guess, funny, but odd. But I think it highlights the fact that everyone's so on edge because of terrorist attacks. That this happened in New York a while ago at one of the airports out there. I think it was JFK, you know, to where somebody hears a sound, they see something strange, and then panic ensues, and nothing even happened.
Yeah, obviously you shouldn't dress up in a costume like that. That could easily cause panic. And it also sounds like a lot of the airport travelers went to the wrong place. They sprinted out to the tarmac, which is totally flat and not a lot of cover. I would bunker down in a restroom or something and probably have more safety that way from a shooter.
Yeah. Well, and you can totally understand. I mean, if you're at an airport and people just start running, you don't know what's going on. So you probably would run too. And so just even the threat of terrorism is enough to make just to interrupt business and delay flights. And it can happen. I mean, you hear a sound, somebody gets nervous, I think they heard a gun go off, you know. So anyway, it is interesting because it just does highlight that fact that sometimes we run when there's nothing even there.
Yeah, that's kind of the point of terrorism, too, is to really just make us afraid of our own shadows and just scared for no reason a lot of the time.
So interesting out there in LAX. This was a kind of a strange story from over the weekend, too. There was a lightning strike in Norway. And it killed 323 wild reindeer. Did you see this one?
No.
Yeah, it's crazy. They say more than 300 wild reindeer have been killed by lightning in central Norway in what wildlife officials are calling an unusually large natural disaster. The Norwegian Environment Agency has released eerie images, and you can see them all over the internet, showing a jumble of reindeer carcasses scattered across a small area of a mountain plateau. The agency says 323 animals were killed, including 70 calves, in the lightning storm Friday. They say it's not uncommon for reindeer or other wildlife to be killed by lightning strikes, but obviously 323 is a very large number, larger than they've ever seen before. During storms, reindeer do get close together to try to ride out the bad weather, so that can obviously put them in a situation like this. But still, 323, that's unheard of.
Yeah, you could stop by and pick up some free pre-cooked reindeer meat, I guess, if you're smart.
Well, I was wondering about that. You know, a lot of times if you see a dead animal, obviously you stay away from it. You don't know what killed it. But in this case, if they know, I just wonder, well, what are you going to do with them? I mean, they're already dead. Do you try to use them for something? I mean, or just bury them? I don't know what they would do with them. It seems like you might want to try to do something with them.
Yeah, I don't want to be too insensitive about that, but 323, that's a ridiculous number, so kind of caught me off guard there.
Yeah, it's, It'd be interesting to see what they do with them because, you don't want to just leave them. So that would be strange to come upon that. You know, you walk over the hill and there's 323 dead reindeer.
Yeah, I mean, do you have a burial or do you try to use the meat? I mean, it just kind of, it's probably unprecedented pretty much.
Yeah, really strange. So I know anytime you have lightning, I mean, you always have to be careful. We had a lightning storm here in the summer, I remember, that was pretty intense. And a lot of us were here because we were having the Philadelphia youth camp, and it was the end of that camp here on the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College. So when the final evening was over and was going home, it was lightning, like what? It looked just crazy out there. And you know, you start to kind of look around because of the flashes and everything, and you have to be careful with that. So occasionally people get hit. It's not that uncommon, but to have something like this is really pretty unprecedented. So 323 wild reindeer dead. So strange situation there. One other story here. This is not good in relation to the upcoming election. FBI says foreign hackers penetrated state election systems. So that's not good. The FBI has uncovered evidence that foreign hackers penetrated two state election databases in recent weeks, prompting the Bureau to warn election officials across the country to take new steps to enhance the security of their computer systems. Those concerns prompted Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson to convene a conference call with state election officials on August 15th, in which he offered his department's help to make state voting systems more secure. So, you know, there's always, Donald Trump even came out, you know, and said if he doesn't win, it's rigged. And so there's that whole rhetoric that's out there. And then when you have the potential people hacking the systems, it makes the whole thing a little nerve-wracking, I think.
Yeah, who knows if the actual votes will come out the way they were supposed to whenever any random hacker seems like can get into these systems. We're just so vulnerable to that now. We hear about this so often in all these different areas. We're just getting hacked over and over again, and we can't even seem to stop it.
Well, if Vladimir Putin wins the U.S. election, I think we could guess that Russia hacked us.
100% to zero.
So that would be one giveaway. But we'll see what happens there. He wasn't even on the ballot. How did that happen? But you're right. I mean, we are very vulnerable to any type of hacks. This has happened. I mean, the Hillary Clinton's email server, of course, and the Democratic National Convention, their systems were hacked. And there's supposed to be, I guess, some big October surprise coming. They're going to release more information.
I'm looking forward to that. I'm kind of nervously, but it does sound exciting.
What's the surprise? Yeah. So anyway, anything that gets put out there on those systems can be taken advantage of. So that'll be interesting to see how that that goes there. But the FBI is keeping their eye on that. We've got a few stories here today from the "Of course, this happened" segment, a buildup from over the weekend, I guess, of bizarre occurrences that are happening in this world. Postal worker stashed nearly 50,000 pieces of undelivered mail in her California apartment. Where it must be a big apartment. Where's all the? Where would you hide all that stuff?
Yeah, I know. A lot of the time they're on a tight schedule, so if they don't deliver it all on time, they probably don't want to come back to the post office and say, "Hey, this is the stuff I didn't deliver."
Yeah.
Or maybe she just saw big packages and thought that they might have something important in them.
Yeah, her name is Sherry Watanabe. She hid approximately 48,288 pieces of United States mail in her apartment. they counted it. The mail was intended for delivery to customers along Watanabe's route in Orange County, California there. She's 48 years old, was named in a one-count felony criminal information filed Wednesday in U.S. District Court in Los Angeles. So according to the plea agreement, she was hired as a mail carrier in June 2006. She began collecting, quote, large quantities of such mail in her residence in 2011, while the undelivered mail was seized by law enforcement agents in late 2013. Court filings do not indicate why more than 2 years passed before she was charged. I think they had a little bit of evidence on her there. You know, like 48,288 pieces of it.
Yeah, at first I thought you said just 50, but I guess 50,000. Yeah, 50,000. That is a pretty big apartment probably then.
Yeah, yeah. If I said 50, I meant 50,000.
No, you probably didn't.
There's just a whole lot of it. So they said that she could get up to 3 years in custody, but prosecutors have agreed to recommend that a term of imprisonment not exceed the low end of that. So in similar previous prosecutions, mail carriers have claimed that the volume on their routes was so onerous that they opted to hide the mail instead of delivering it. So that's the excuse, at least in the other cases. They had too much mail, so they just hid it all in their apartment or wherever. That's disconcerting if you're trying to mail something because you kind of want it to get where it's supposed to be going.
Yeah, I actually, one time I tried to get a magazine subscription, and I put a $20 bill in the envelope, which is not a good idea because it can easily get stolen. But I never got the subscription, and I just always, ever since, I've been kind of suspicious about if the mail will ever get to the place that I want it to.
Yeah, maybe your neighbors got it.
Who knows? Maybe I put the wrong address on there. It's been my fault this whole time.
Well, sometimes, you know, that you do see stories where, like, somebody gets a letter that a relative sent to them in, like, 1942. You know, it shows up all of a sudden. They're like, why deliver it at that point? You know, it's just strange. I don't know if it'd be better to deliver it or just let it go. And just the fact that there's over 48,000 pieces of mail in this lady's apartment, I mean, that's quite a while that she's been hiding it. And I guess probably you do it once, and then you think, and you just, you know, keep rolling along. Before you know it, almost 50,000 pieces of mail are sitting there.
Yeah, you'd have to be smart about that. If you're going to be a mail thief, you can't do nearly 50,000 pieces. Maybe a few thousand over that same amount of time. But she's just hoarding it into her apartment, and she thinks that all these thousands of customers are never going to say a single thing about it.
She, it'd be hard to have people over, you know, for dinner.
What's all this?
Never mind that. Just some mail.
Probably none of it opened, or at least a lot of it.
Yeah, I imagine most of it's junk mail.
Wow.
If the mail I get is any indication. Most of it, you know, very rarely it's just something of relevance.
Exactly.
So anyway, kind of a interesting story there. They always, you know, a lot of times they'll make fun of postal workers on different TV shows, like that they do that, like it's a joke, but it actually does happen.
Some do. I actually heard a celebrity talking about it recently. He got fired from that job because he wouldn't finish, and he tried to be like, oh, well, I'll go do it the next day on the route, and he kept getting further and further behind on the mail he was given to deliver because he just pushed it to the next day.
Yeah.
And finally, the guy was like, look, you're just a terrible mailman. This is not for you.
And just,
for just fired him.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, you've got to deliver it all. I mean, sometimes you see that where I haven't seen it so much with the Postal Service, but sometimes you'll see it's like FedEx or UPS delivering pretty late. You know, 9:30 at night, you see the truck drive by, and like, wow, that guy's got a lot of packages.
Yeah, just working long days. They really are expected to do a lot in some cases.
Yep, so the mail just keeps coming. No one stops it.
It's almost like it's encouraging crime when you give them such a huge workload, too.
Yeah, it's hard.
You got to be balanced about it.
I wonder if they, there's probably certain routes that are better than others, you know, that you'd prefer to have. But interesting story. This is another one from the Of Course This Is Happening. This one just defies all logic and reason. It says, do you prefer ma'am or sir? New Department of Justice video shows cops how to treat transgender people. They have a video, training video for the police. If you pull somebody over or if you come to a crime scene and you're not sure what the gender is, or they have a different gender than what their license says, there's like these guidelines now for how they have to handle this.
Yeah, the Department of Justice seems to be wasting a lot of time on pushing like a social justice type agenda. I watched a good amount of this video. It was hard to tolerate for 12 whole minutes, so I skipped here and there. But yeah, the guy pulls over this transgender woman at just for a random traffic stop. And I guess a transgender woman is someone who was originally a man and turned into a woman.
Okay.
That's always been confusing to me, too. But the video clarified that for me, thankfully. But basically, the police officer says, sorry, do you prefer ma'am or sir? Now, if someone said that to me, that would make me angry. Like, what, you can't tell what I am?
Yeah.
So it just seems like that would actually escalate an issue, especially after you had just pulled someone over.
Yeah, that would be insulting. Like, what are you getting at?
Why not just not address a person that way?
Just say hello.
Avoid the issue. This isn't a video of guidelines, and that's the first one they come to seems really offensive.
Yeah, just say, hello, may I see your license?
Exactly. It's so easy to avoid, and they make it, you're drawing more attention to it when you talk about it that way. I mean,
And it'd be so tempting to say back to the officer, well, I'm not sure. What do you prefer? You know, then you'd have a problem. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's another part of the video where a mother is holding her young child, and she had called the police because another transgender woman had been in the restroom with them. So originally a man became a woman, apparently, and went into the women's restroom. And the police officer went into the restaurant and was looking for the person who I guess apparently went to the restroom, and basically they were flippant toward the officer, said, "We're just trying to have lunch." And then the guy was like, "I am a woman." And it was just strange stuff. And every one of them, you know, just does not look normal. It's something that we shouldn't be encouraging by making guidelines about it.
Yeah. Every time there's some new odd change to society, then they have to have new odd guidelines to deal with it. Yeah. Really odd.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's only 700,000 transgender in the entire U.S. And their suicide rate is like akin to the Jews during World War II.
Wow.
So like nearly one in every 100,000. And that's the only comparable suicide rate ever. And a lot of studies have said that transgenderism is a mental disorder. And yet we're trying to make it normal by giving out these guidelines to police,
yeah,
among other things.
Yeah. Of all the time and the money probably that was put into that, it could be spent better somewhere else, it would seem. Here's one more from the Of Course This Happened segment. Escaped teenager requests different mugshot photo after Sydney jailbreak. 18-year-old woman. She was wanted by police in Australia, and she responded to a post on Facebook asking a TV station to use a different picture of herself. She was on the run. The police put out a photo, said, "Have you seen this lady?" And she responds and says, "Could you use a better picture?"
Did she get caught from it?
So far, not that I could see. But she commented underneath a post from her personal profile, which called for her arrest, politely requesting that they use a different photo of herself. She wrote, "Can you use this photo, please? And thank you. Yours truly." And then she signed her name.
This is a real risk taker. Trying to put herself out there and get caught.
Well, yeah, I mean, of all her concerns in life at this moment, probably the photo is not the big issue there, but she was concerned about how, you know, everybody's a brand, right? She didn't want her social media brand to be besmirched.
That's right.
By an inappropriate photo.
Yeah, I think recently this picture of this really good-looking guy who was in trouble went viral because a bunch of people thought he was attractive, and he gained some notoriety from that. So maybe she was trying to take a lesson from it.
Actually, that's what I thought of too, because there are some websites that are dedicated to that, like, you know, the attractive mugshot.
Yeah.
I just actually got my license renewed last week, and it's the worst picture ever, maybe in the history of man. I looked at it, I'm like, oh, come on. You know, I even made a joke about it to the lady there, and she wouldn't, like, reshoot it for me.
That's how they are.
I was like, come on, this is the worst picture ever. Till 2020, this is me now.
Were you blinking or anything like that?
I didn't know what to look at. There was, this thing there, and she said, look at that. And I was looking between the two things, and it just looked terrible.
Yeah, my new one I took a couple weeks ago, and it looks like I'm looking at the ground because I couldn't tell what to look at either. I thought I was looking right at it.
Well, I think I'm too tall for it.
Yeah.
And so I'm looking down on it, and I just look terrible. So I joked with the lady. I'm like, well, if this ends up being my mugshot, this is horrible. And she's like, okay, move on. That should make a little banter at the DMV.
Isn't that they're government employees, so there's not a whole lot of accountability there.
No, I would have preferred one more shot. Like, can I have one more go at it?
I'll pay extra. I would pay extra.
I've actually had some over the years that have been pretty nice about it and have showed me and said, hey, do you like this one? I'm like, oh, that's fine. You know, this wasn't the case. They were in and out. And
it costs a lot of money, too. So you'd think that they would at least let you get a decent photo on there.
I'm going to Photoshop my own, I think.
You should.
Put it back on there, yeah.
Might get arrested, but at least it'd look better.
Well, now I know what to do if I ever get in trouble and they're looking for me. I say, can you use a better photo? Can you go back to my old license? This doesn't accurately represent my attractiveness level. So those are some of the things that are happening in this world, some of the bizarre occurrences that are happening. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury from Edstone, England. Today talks about the New York Times. They're being critical of Russian media and Vladimir Putin for just being propaganda, inventing the narrative instead of reporting facts. But the same New York Times very recently praised Ben Rhodes and Obama administration for creating a false narrative to push the Iran nuclear deal. So both sides of their mouth there.
Right. The New York Times said that other administrations or other governments could use the Obama administration as a model for how to explain foreign policy to the public. Russia is just getting a head start on that. So where's the criticism coming from?
Well, right. And it's like, it's not even a head start. I mean, it's been going on forever in terms of, you know, the Nazis, the communists. You know, after Hitler was killed, the communists for years said he was still alive, mm-hmm. even though they probably had his body, I think, where he was burned, of course, but they knew where it was. And but they just lied about it all the time. They just lied constantly. You know, the Nazis lied all the time. It's not a new thing. It's not a new thing at all. It's presented like, oh, brilliant stroke of, I'm like, well, you're just lying. That's been happening for years.
Yeah, and today there's a huge stigma against ever calling someone a liar or saying that they lie. You like to use terms like misrepresenting the truth, or I misspoke, or some of the details are hazy, and it's never you lied. That's what it is.
Well, that's true. Yeah, you never see that really come up in stories where they just say, you know, hey, been caught lying. They always say, well, yeah, like you say, misrepresented or couldn't recall or any of those things, which used to, when people were kids and they try that, usually you couldn't get away with it. You get caught pretty quick. Yeah, you're telling a lie. But somehow these institutions, whether it's the media or whether it's high-ranking officials, they can just kind of go on their way.
Yeah, in the social media age, too, another excuse is I got hacked. So everyone has a reason to say that whenever they lied, there's a good excuse for it.
Yeah, we just have to try that outside of the social media realm. You know, I got hacked. My brain got hacked.
In real life. I short-circuited. That's what Hillary Clinton said recently.
Oh, that's right.
Short-circuited. So pretty much the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Really good Trump Daily Radio show. A few other things are talked about as well. But that New York Times part is interesting, and the show kicks off with that. And then there's a few other topics that are gotten into on the Trumpet Daily Show today. Make sure you listen for that. We are going to take a quick break, and when we return, we're going to talk about what's going on with the preppers up in the Pacific Northwest. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live.
We'll be right back to Trumpet Radio Live.
Hello, I'm Ryan Malone, host of Music for Life. And in our next episode, we will be exploring one of the most famous lyrics of all time, a Hebrew word that has been used throughout millennia and throughout all sorts of different languages and religious denominations. In our Sounds of Scripture segment, we will explore the origins of this word and how it has survived as the phrase of choice in sacred songs of praise. And in our Classroom Corner segment, we're going to see the power of praise in the music classroom and what kind of praise specifically fosters more growth in the music student. So join me for an absolutely uplifting and exuberant episode of Music for Life, simply titled Hallelujah.
Join Ryan Malone on Music for Life this Monday at 4 p.m. Central on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at KPCGFM. And if you'd like to email us any questions, comments, concerns, anything, you can send those to comments at kpcg.fm. We had some nice comments over the weekend from some of our listeners all over the place. We have one in Washington, D.C. that was particularly friendly, said we did a good job, so thank you.
Made me extremely happy to read that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice to get a little pat on the back. It's better than a punch in the stomach.
That's for sure.
Words to live by there. This is a pretty interesting story here that, Grant, you've got for us. The term prepper, that's something that's, I think, kind of out there. People know about that. It's people that are looking at the situation in the world, and they're saying, you know what, I'm nervous about the way things are going. I think things are going to go bad, and I'm going to prepare myself. So I'm going to, you know, they're prepping. This write-up is a fortress against fear in the rural Pacific Northwest, prepping for the day that things get really bad. What are the details here?
Yes, a lot of people are preparing for the end of the world as we know it. They're cashing out and investing in gold and silver and moving everything they own and moving their entire lives up to the Redoubt, which is a region of lightly populated territory in Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, and Eastern Washington and Oregon. So there are a lot of people going up there, largely Christian conservatives, who have just a clear view of all the problems that are taking place in America today, and they want to get away from the highly populated, more liberal areas where the problems are going to explode first.
Yeah, and this has been going on for a while, and we were talking about it before we got on the air, and there's a lot of websites about this type of activity. There's books about it. I think there might even be some television shows, if I can recall correctly. And they're very popular. I mean, people are thinking about it. They're thinking about like you say, cashing out, getting their money, buying gold and silver, making bullets. In this case, I think this article talked about that, arming themselves and just getting away from populated areas. And it's becoming more of a popular thing with some people.
Yeah, hugely popular. A portable freeze dryer company recently, or just 2 years ago, they only sold 40 of these freeze dryers a month, or 80 a month. And now they sell 900 a month. So 80 up to 900 every single month. Just in the span of 2 years, it's gone up 820 units per month.
You know, and this really isn't, I mean, it is a new phenomenon in a way, but it's not in another way. You think back to the, you know, generations past, people were building bomb shelters. You know, that's not as common anymore, but it used to be the fear in the during the Cold War, the fear of bombs. So people had bomb shelters and those types of things. And now this is kind of a new iteration of that. Just getting away from everybody and building your little bunker out there in the woods.
Yeah, some companies are selling bunkers that sleep up to six or eight people and cost around $150,000. That's a serious structure there. And a lot of people are investing in that. Different websites about survivalism and different books about the same subject are getting hundreds of thousands or even millions of page hits or buys. So people are really starting to wake up to all the problems we see today.
And of course, there's a whole segment then that mocks these people as well, you know, and kind of makes fun of them for what they're doing and getting out to those more woodsy areas, I guess, and trying to get away from society. But I think if anybody's paying attention to, say, headlines, I think they can understand some of the nervousness. I think you can understand the fact that people are trying to come up with a plan ahead for what they see as trouble. So there's a lot of people on both sides of this. Some people think it's a good idea. Other people think it's ridiculous.
That's right. A lot of people, the natives who are already living up in that redoubt region in the Pacific Northwest, sort of roll their eyes at all the newcomers who have been packing up and moving up there. But the thing is, none of them are dangerous. They're religious people who keep to themselves. They favor small government. The reason they moved up there in the first place is a lot of these local governments are largely hands-off and conservative as it is, which does fit their viewpoints. There's a lot of nature, wildlife up there, water supplies. So they move up there, and it is a sensible area to go. It's largely insulated from natural disasters. There aren't big cities with its accompanying crime and violence. It's a good spot to hide out.
Well, it seems like wouldn't be a bad existence just in terms of today, you know, away from a lot of that stuff. But these people are thinking about, like, the world as they know it coming crashing down, and they're hoping to survive it. They have plans, I guess, for several years, hoping that'll be enough to get them through to whatever comes next.
Yes, a lot of them, they don't really talk about exactly how much they have in their stockpiles, but probably several years' worth. And they're becoming better and better at hunting and fishing so they can provide for themselves that way. They're getting water purifiers so that even if the water becomes contaminated, they can still have drinking water. They really are putting in a lot of preparation. And it's expensive, too. A lot of these properties that are selling up there to these redoubt settlers are going for $2 million.
Wow.
So you have to have some money. You can't just be aware of it. You also have to have some money to be able to get up there.
You've got to have money to survive the end of the world. That's mm-hmm. that's one of the lessons, I guess.
That's true.
Well, what do they think's going to happen? I mean, because some of these things that they're talking about could be fine in certain situations. But what about... What about nuclear war? What about that?
Yeah, that's the thing. I think this area might be insulated from a lot of the issues. Some of them worry about hurricanes, earthquakes, forest fires. Others do fear a nuclear attack or a solar flare that creates an electromagnetic pulse that would then knock out the nation's entire electric grid for perhaps forever. So those things, even nuclear war... They are going to target the big cities first. It's just a matter of how big the bomb is that is dropped, because clearly if it's going to cover the whole country, they won't get away.
Yeah, we have radiation. You have the fallout from that. And I've read some about some of these folks, and they, in some cases, they do have bomb shelters where they can stay in there for a while. But, you know, it's interesting because they talk, in some cases, and they spend a lot of money on it, they can stay in there with, you know, four or five people for 2-3 years. And I just think, well, that would be horrible.
It would never see the light of day.
No, right.
For years at a time. That so this is an insulated area, but what about a foreign attack? What if an army just comes up there? So there are things that we know are coming that they can't necessarily protect themselves from. But what else are you going to do if you're relying on yourself for protection? They're doing pretty much as best they can.
Well, it's interesting because these particular people in this one write-up here from the Washington Post talks about them being sort of religious, I guess, in a way, and they have their Bible studies and that. But if they're looking into Bible prophecy, it talks about people not escaping those sorts of problems. So they're doing their best, but if they're looking into their Bibles, I don't know what they're looking at.
They're missing a big part that says, unless Christ returned, every single person on the entire earth would die. So that is a pretty serious prophecy. It makes you wonder what it really takes, because these people seem religious. They seem to be reading their Bibles, but they're still not turning to the right place for solutions.
Yeah, I mean, they're putting their trust in themselves, I guess, mm-hmm. which, of course, if they know their Bibles a little bit too, it's, you know, cursed be the man that trusts in man. Mm-hmm. So they're looking to themselves to try to stay alive and be protected. But, you know, if they read a little history too, you think about, say, World War II in Europe there, and there were a lot of people that had some protective measures in place. But I tell you what, when those Russian armies came through Germany, nobody got out of there unless, I mean, some people did, but they didn't get out of it by hiding in the bunker. They came through and decimated that area. So war doesn't usually work that way, where they just ignore people.
Yeah. Yeah. I could imagine these people in these areas surviving, if maybe survivors in the big cities that were bombed came and tried to steal their supplies, they could probably protect themselves. They have a lot of weapons, but a foreign invader, they're not going to be able to stand against that. That's the issue. That's the one obvious vulnerability here. But they don't necessarily know the next thing that's going to happen. They feel like 95% of these crises they could avert with the setup they have right now.
Right. They feel like things are bad, they're going to get bad, and they're just trying to prepare for it, although it's a guess. Like you said, you know, a big solar flare or, you know. Obviously, they're trying to become self-sufficient. So if technology gets knocked out, or if the supply lines that we all rely on of food and fuel somehow get interrupted, they can survive for a time, and maybe they will for a time. But again, if they're looking into some of their Bible prophecies, it's not going to last very long.
Yeah, they do have a Bible study every Monday night, it says, in a lot of these areas. So what part are they missing about how this is all going to play out? A lot of them are understandably concerned about President Obama's and also Hillary Clinton's ideas about possibly scrapping the right to bear arms.
Yeah.
And also they see a dangerous anti-constitutionalist movement toward government that is too intrusive, too hostile, and anti-personal liberty. So they do see some of the big problems that are taking place right now. They think that any factor could lead to crippling chaos, so they're preparing for it. Some other things they said were that the president has inflamed racial tensions in America. That's a huge issue, and that he's also presided over a gigantic expansion of the national debt, and he's failed to curtail the nuclear ambitions of nations like North Korea and Iran that are our clear enemies.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised these people are, you know, talking about where they're going. You think you'd keep it quiet. You wouldn't want people knowing that you've got this big old storage system up there and all these supplies. People know where you are. I mean, they might come looking for it.
The article does mention briefly that a lot of these people don't even tell their family members where they went. But
they're just off the grid. They just disappeared.
Yeah, but you know, the Washington Post probably has resources of finding people. I mean, this is in parts of 5 states. This is nearly a tenth of the entire country's states. So they were able to find it, but it's not like they're out there advertising it because they don't want the vast majority of people to know about it.
Yeah. Well, it'd be interesting to see how that goes for those people. It is kind of a new movement in a way. And You know, in a sense, it is interesting because if you look back just a few generations, say the Depression era in this country or World War II time, which is kind of the same period, people did know a little bit more about how to survive, just basic things that I think most people don't know about today. You know, you read some of that history, and they knew how to go into the woods and look for something and knew how to make something of it to at least have a meal for a few days. But I think today we would just, when Walmart doesn't have food, I don't know, the panic would ensue pretty quickly.
Yeah, these people talk about how they're getting back to the pioneering ways of their ancestors, living off the land, figuring out ways to conquer different obstacles without necessarily relying on other people to provide.
Yeah. Well, actually, it was really good. I hadn't thought of that, but when they mentioned the forest fires, I mean, that's true. They're right up there in the woods. A big fire come through, nothing
they
could
do. That's a big one.
Even if it was just like some sort of a natural fire that you know, lightning strike or something. You know, there's so many things that when you're at the mercy sort of I guess, nature that, you know, people don't, you can plan for everything and then something else happens. So
that's true. They are vulnerable to quite a few things still, even if less so than most people. But I think they'll take being less vulnerable than most people.
Yeah. Well, they're trying to do something anyway. They have some sort of a plan going forward. It's kind of interesting write-up. There's a video with it, too. The title is A Fortress Against Fear in the Rural Pacific Northwest, prepping for the day things get pretty bad up there. Or, I guess, anywhere. Hopefully not there, because that's where they're trying to hide out. Pretty interesting write-up there, Washington Post. Here's a really interesting one, too. And this one's pretty frightening, really. It's from the New York Post. Title is, It's Digital Heroin, How Screens Turn Kids into Psychotic Junkies.
What a title.
It doesn't sound good, and it's one of those things that's always a little touchy because a lot of people do have screens, and their kids have screens. And we talked about last week how a lot of the college students coming into college, or I guess any of the college students in the U.S. universities, 50% of them have these issues, mental issues. I don't know if it's related to this or not, but it could be part of it. It says Susan, name changed, of course, bought her 6-year-old son John an iPad when he was in first grade. She said, I thought, why not let him get a jump on things? She told me during a therapy session. The person writing this article is a therapist dealing with people having these problems. John's school had begun using the devices with younger and younger grades, and his technology teacher had raved about their educational benefits. So Susan wanted to do what was best for her sandy-haired boy who loved reading and playing baseball. So she gets him an iPad and gets him some educational games that he can play and so forth. And at first, it seemed like things were going pretty well. He liked the device. It was a lot of fun. He seemed engaged in creative play as he explored the cube world of the game. So they're playing this game with these cubes. I think it might have been Minecraft even. I'm not exactly sure if it was that game, but it
sounds pretty close, at least.
Something like that. It's supposed to be sort of educational. Still, the write-up says, Susan couldn't deny that she was seeing changes in John. Again, he's 6 years old. He started getting more and more focused on his game and losing interest in baseball and reading while refusing to do his chores. Some mornings, he would wake up and tell her that he could see the cube shapes in his dreams. So, you know, we've all been there where you're doing something all day and you close your eyes and you kind of see the same, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was a kid, sometimes in the summer, we'd go out and we'd pick berries for a good part of the day, and you close your eyes, that's what you see. You know, that's what you're looking at. So I think we were all familiar with our brains and the way they make those things happen sometimes. It says, although that concerned her, she thought her son might just be exhibiting an active imagination. As his behavior continued to deteriorate, she tried to take the game away, but John threw temper tantrums. His outbursts were so severe that she gave in, still rationalizing to herself over and over again that, well, it's an educational game. It's not a bad game. It says, then one night she realized that something was seriously wrong. She said, I walked into his room to check on him. He was supposed to be sleeping, and I was just so frightened, she says. She found him sitting up in his bed, staring wide-eyed, his bloodshot eyes looking into the distance as his glowing iPad lay next to him. He was just sitting there, staring into oblivion. The game was next. He wasn't playing the game. He was just in this weird sort of state. She said he seemed to be in a trance. Beside herself with panic, Susan had to shake the boy repeatedly to snap him out of it. Distraught, she could not understand how her once healthy and happy little boy had become so addicted to the game that he wound up in a catatonic stupor.
Wow, that sounds exactly like the effects of drugs, how you lose interest in the important parts of life and just only thing you can think about, only thing you even dream about, and are obsessed with at all times is the drug.
And that's exactly the point that they're building to here, and they have research to show that's the case. They say we know that those iPads, smartphones, and Xboxes are a form of a digital drug. Recent brain imaging research is showing that they affect the brain's frontal cortex, which controls executive functioning, including impulse control, in exactly the same way that cocaine does. Technology is so hyper-arousing that it raises dopamine levels, the feel-good neurotransmitter most involved in the addiction dynamic. And so they say that's why they call it electronic cocaine and the Chinese call it digital heroin.
Wow.
And you know what's really interesting? The people that are very much behind developing these technologies, their children, they send them to schools that have no technology in them, very specifically, because they know what it does.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of different CEOs or inventors do that same thing. Even food manufacturers of junky foods, they don't ever eat the stuff that they make. It seems like you have to be closely involved with the product to realize just how dangerous it actually is.
Yeah, and that was a real eye-opener for me when I read that about the parents, the ones that are developing. I mean, we're talking about some really high-profile people here that are behind some of the major technologies that we all use. They make sure their kids are going to schools that don't have the iPads, that don't have the computers, so they're, you know, learning in other ways because, again, they know what it does. This article says, that's right, get this, your kid's brain on Minecraft looks like a brain on drugs.
Oh.
Looks exactly the same when they look at the imaging.
That is insane. That just shows how dangerous it is. And I see a lot of the time technology's benefits are vastly outweighed by the drawbacks. So that is something to consider, especially with children and their education.
Absolutely. And again, it's not like some of these games would be considered bad. I mean, you know, they're not like shoot 'em up, you know, violent games, but they're still doing something to the brain. It says, no wonder we have a hard time peeling kids from their screens and find our little ones agitated when their screen time is interrupted. In addition, hundreds of clinical studies show that screens increase depression, anxiety, and aggression, and can even lead to psychotic-like features where the video gamer loses touch with reality. I mean, how many kids have we seen over the years go in and shoot up their school? Now, I don't know why all the time, but a lot of times it points back to some of these games.
Yeah, because if you play them all the time, it's like the virtual reality blends into reality, and you kind of lose track of the consequences of actually doing what's in the video game, but instead in real life. A lot of those shooters constantly were playing violent video games, and even if it's not something bad, like you said, the brain is almost deformed as if you're addicted to a drug.
Yeah, it's really shocking. They're finding out more and more about this. I mean, the write-up says, this doctor says, in my clinical work with over 1,000 teens over the past 15 years, so this is a pretty good study. This isn't just some, you know, fly-by-night opinion here. They say, I have found the old axiom of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure to be especially true when it comes to tech addiction. Once a kid has crossed the line into true tech addiction, which, of course, is a little bit of a further line than just once in a while, treatment can be very difficult. Indeed, I have found it easier to treat heroin and crystal meth addicts than lost in the matrix video gamers or Facebook-dependent social media addicts. Can you believe that?
Yeah, well, I guess there are a lot more things you can do on a screen than you can do with a drug. So if you think about it that way, all the different options you're taking away from someone when you take away just one screen, it really is probably a lot more impactful on someone's life than giving up a drug.
And, you know, with those terrible drugs they mentioned, I mean, people, they're killing them, and they know that it is, and they can't stop it, and they do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it's harder to quit some of this tech, of course, the difficulty there is that it doesn't have the exact same immediate, obvious downside, I suppose. You think, well, what's the big deal? I like Facebook. It's not like I'm on heroin, right? But
well,
what's it doing long term? Yeah, it is. What's it going to do long term? And I mean, that's something we don't even really know, because you start talking about Facebook or these other technologies, they're relatively new.
Mm.
It's not like we can go and look at somebody that spent their last 40 years addicted to Facebook, what that person becomes. We don't know.
Yeah, and speaking of detaching a child from a device like that, you can probably relate, but a couple of times my wife has walked past and just kind of grab the phone out of my hand. I'm like, hey, wait a second. What are you doing here? And it's like a quick moment of panic because she took my phone. But then I realize how trivial it is and I get over it. But if you're really addicted to it, then that's when the tantrums come. That's when you feel like your life is ending just because someone took the screen away.
Yeah, it really does affect people. And again, like this is pointing out, these young kids. See, for somebody like myself, I never got on the internet until I was probably 17, because that's when it first became sort of available, and it was only at work. It was at my job. And there was one computer
a
that had
one.
It.
Was it a huge one?
Well, it was a lot bigger than the ones today. There was one computer that had it. Like, we didn't even know what to do with it. You know, we kind of look around, I guess. And, you know, we weren't sure what to do with it, really. But it wasn't part of our day-to-day life. It wasn't part of my upbringing. I mean, television was, because it was there. But definitely not these social media sort of apps or the games or technologies. But now we have young kids that sometimes almost, like they say, they learn to get on these things before they can walk or speak.
Yeah, I've seen babies playing on a screen for hours at a time. And it is a bit disturbing because, right, they can't hardly do anything else except for eat and sleep. And they can't even walk or speak yet.
There was yesterday, even as an example, I was we went to one of the malls and we were walking around with the family doing a little shopping. And, you know, when you're a young person, when you're a kid, typically that's fun. That's an exciting thing. Like that's the fun of the day. We're going to go to this mall. And one of the stores, there was this younger child, I don't know, probably 10 years old, crunched up in the corner of the store while the parents were shopping or something, playing a game. Yeah, you see that everywhere. And it's like, but this is fun, though. You're here at this like mall, and there are people, and it's fun here. But they're in the corner in their own world playing this game.
Yeah, when I was younger, my mom and grandmother used to go out clothes shopping for hours. You know, that was fun at first for a minute for me.
Yeah.
But I'm not, you know, clothes shopping for hours, it does get old. But I would get in the corner with a book. I mean, they wouldn't let me have a screen and just unlimited access to that the whole time. And at least when you're reading, you know, you're actively engaging the mind. You're not getting drowned in a screen.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. Maybe they've been dragging the kid around all day. I guess that could be possible.
It can get boring, but yeah. That's not the good. Just pacifying a child with a screen doesn't seem like the best idea.
They say in this write-up here, it says the key to prevent your 4, 5, or 8-year-old from getting hooked on screens is to prevent them from getting hooked on screens to begin with. That's the best thing to do. They say that means Lego instead of Minecraft. Books instead of iPads, which speaks to your point there, Grant. nature and sports instead of TV. If you have to, demand your child's school not give them a tablet or a Chromebook until they are at least 10 years old. Others recommend 12. It says, in the end, my client Susan, the one that this story was about, removed John's tablet, but recovery was an uphill battle with many bumps and setbacks along the way. And so once the kids get hooked on it, you're in a battle the rest of your life trying to pull those things away.
Yeah, and the kid doesn't really have much control over getting into that addiction in the first place. It's all up to what the parent allows him to do.
So they mentioned a few things here, obviously, you know, try to give your kids games, you know, like sports to play, books to read, try to have no computer in their bedroom, a nightly tech-free dinner. Isn't that funny? Can we have a tech-free dinner for once around here?
Yeah, it's amazing how rare that is now. But even that commercial we were talking about the other day with the pepper shaker button,
yeah,
taking out all the Wi-Fi, I mean, really we shouldn't need that because all these 7-year-old kids don't necessarily need their own screen to begin with.
Yeah, it's a different time than it ever has been. And people are doing things that seem, you know, harmless, entertaining. But now they're finding out this is doing things to people. It's reforming their brains in ways that aren't great, especially young kids. And they're having a hard time connecting with the world around them. They're calling it digital heroin or digital cocaine. It's that serious when the mind gets hooked on those things. So pretty eye-opening write-up.
Yeah, it is. It's sobering, and hopefully people can read that and make changes. And it is hard, but dealing with a child's temper tantrum isn't necessarily the worst thing that you'll ever have to face.
Yeah, they'll thank you for it in the long run.
Yeah.
When they aren't addicted to some of those different devices and things. So pretty interesting, changing times. You can read the rest of that if you'd like to. That is at the New York Post. The title is It's Digital Heroin, How Screens Turn Kids into Psychotic junkies. Pretty eye-opening story there. Key of David program and the Trumpet Daily Radio Show are coming up here on KPCG. You can get the archives of these programs online at kpcg.fm as well. And also being Monday, you can listen to a new episode of Just the Best Literature with your host, Dennis Leap. And also, there's a new Music for Life with your host, Ryan Malone, that's coming up as well. And so hopefully you'll enjoy all those programs today. Thanks for spending your Monday with us here on Trumpet Radio Live. For myself, Dwight Falk, and Grant Turgeon, have a great rest of your Monday, and we'll see you back here tomorrow. You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, kpcg.fm.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.